Hello, and welcome to the Shotgun Sportsman, a podcast about handgun hunting brought to you by Handgun Hunters International. My name is Ryan Hoover, and I'm your host. I believe handgun hunting is the most rewarding way to hunt, and it's something I want to share with as many people as I can. If you are at all interested in getting your own game meat, I want to challenge you to a way of hunting that is good for both your spirit and your body, so you can become the confident, self-reliant person you were meant to be. Okay, today's podcast is about another handgun competition. Last episode, we talked about Handgun Hunters Competition. Today, we're going to talk about the competition that follows a couple days later in Gillette, Wyoming, Wyshot. Wyshot is the brainchild of Ernie Bishop, and it is a specialty pistol competition held in Wyoming at long ranges. You can expect to shoot from anywhere from as close as 200 yards out to past 1,400 yards during the competition. It's a fantastic opportunity to learn how to drop and drift, holdovers, spotting, call and wind, all that stuff. It's a lot of fun, and I recommend you go. Ernie and I talked about the details of this competition, the equipment that you'll need, how it works, where to stay, when it is, all that stuff. So I hope you enjoy my interview with Ernie Bishop. Ernie Bishop, thank you again for doing the podcast with me. This is your second time on the podcast. Last time we talked about long-range rifle scopes on handguns, which is something I always like to talk with you about. But today we're going to be talking about your competition up in Wyoming, Wyshot. Thanks again.
Well, you're welcome. Good to be able to chat again.
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, kind of walk me through, and this is something that I've never heard myself, walk me through the genesis. How did Wyshot get started? What was the thinking behind it? And how did it come to be?
Well, two things have always been true for quite a while for me. The one that's the longest truth is I love shooting prairie dogs. So going prairie dog shooting is something that I have always enjoyed. And so then second of all, I really prefer to shoot steel over paper for almost all the time. I mean, if I'm trying to get to see how tight something, if I'm going to go to like a rifle competition or a bench rest competition, well, then I'm going to use paper for some fine tuning. But I enjoy shooting steel. I like to hear the sound of it. I like the immediate response to where I can see where I hit most of the time. And so shooting steel and shooting prairie dogs are something I really enjoy with specialty pistols. And so then you just transfer that, that there, when we started this, there was just real no venue that would offer both. And so it was something that I was doing before the MOA shoot. A couple of days for guys that were going to the MOA shoot, I'd invite them out to the same ranch where we do Wyshot now, and we would shoot prairie dogs and shoot steel. So, and then I just got to where I wanted to be able to just do prairie dogs and steel, and that's really the genesis of Wyshot.
That's cool. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. So Wyshot is basically a long-range handgun competition and pretty much exclusively dominated by bolt-action specialty pistols, correct?
On the steel, mm-hmm. On the steel competition part of it, yes, bolt-action specialty pistols pretty much dominate. We have had we've had one or two encores, and we've had an MOA compete in the steel part of it, but by and large, it's pretty much a bolt action specialty pistol.
Right. And for people who are curious about this aspect, the rifle scope thing, they can listen to the podcast we did on that, but most people are running rifle scopes on their specialty pistols at this competition, correct?
In the competition part. Yeah. Yes. I don't know of anyone that's running a pistol scope. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic match. So can you kind of walk me through the equipment that people use there? What kind of, well, first let's start with the guns. We already said they're mostly specialty pistols. What kind of calibers do you see? you know, rear grip versus center grip and other accessories and optics that you see on these things?
Well, there's kind of an equal. There might be more center grips than there are rear grips, but it's fairly close. That's not something I've tried to keep track of. But I would say center grips still pretty much are in the majority. And before we started talking this morning, I was kind of trying to go through my head and remember the chamberings, the cartridges that have been in the top three. And several of them are a little surprising. Mm-hmm. And the two that will be the most surprising probably to you were after we made some rule changes on scoring. But the two that many times people would never put in the top three is a 223 AI. Of course, it was a fast twist and a 308 Winchester. But then 6 Creed, 22 Creed, 284 Winchester, 6.5, 284, 7 SOM, 6.284, 6mm long dasher. Those are cartridges that have made top three. Maybe the 6.5 Creed has made it in there one time, but I don't remember that for sure. But those are cartridges that are being used a lot. And, you know, now you're seeing some 6 GTs, some 22 GTs that are also being used. And the Dasher. Oh, the Dasher would also be one that would have made top three since we started.
Yeah, because, you know, even though, and we'll get into the how it works and the ranges that you're shooting at in a minute, but even though you're shooting at what is, I mean, long range, definitely long range for any type of weapon or any type of gun, a lot of times people are going with you want the lower recoiling. It's like, it's not big boomers is what I'm getting at. You know, a lot of people might have the misconception that shooting at the ranges at which Y-Shot is held, you might need those super magnums, but that's not the case.
That is correct. And we do have some folks that shoot short action magnums, like, you know, some shot the old 6.5 Leopard, which is a 6.5 WSM, and we'll definitely have a 6.5 SOM and the 6.5 PRC. Those will be showing up, but a lot of people are shooting the family of cartridges, you know, on the GT necked up or necked down, the Creed necked up or necked down, or the 243 or the 308 Win family necked up or necked down, or the 284 Winchester family necked down are going to be more of your common cartridges.
Right, right. And so from there, I mean, a lot of those calibers require reloading, not all of them. But when you're talking to people about ammo, what are kind of your suggestions when someone says, okay, either I'm going to buy factory or I'm going to reload, what do they need to look for?
Well, usually if they're going to shoot factory ammo, that's going to, you know, kind of limit them to cartridge that I would recommend, the 6 GT. Hornady makes ammo for the 6 GT with a good bullet for that. And then the Hornady match ammo, the ELDM for the 6 Creed, of course, 6 GT and the 6.5 Creed, which is what you shot when you were there and you were shooting factory ammo. Mm-hmm. I know we've had a third place overall that shot a 6 Creed loaner pistol of mine with a Hornady match ammo and 108 ELDMs, and they took third overall 1 year. And so factory ammo can be competitive at Y-Shot. But if it's reloading, and I just, you know, first of all, they have to have a specialty pistol that has a fast twist barrel for that caliber. And then they have to have a certain skill set to reload to make the gun shoot good.
Right. Yeah, for sure. So just to get back to basics, what you're talking about with a fast twist is because you are, since you're shooting at long range, you're wanting those heavier, longer bullets, and you want that fast twist barrel to be able to stabilize them at that range, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we are shooting, I usually would recommend heavy for caliber bullets that are high BCs. And so for like 22 caliber, from a 6.5 twist to probably an you know, a minimum of 8, depending on what you're going to shoot. And then in 6 millimeter, well, in 25, you know, either a 7 or a 7.5 twist, and a 6, probably a 7.5 twist is what I would recommend, although an 8 will be competitive. And then in 6.5, you're talking typically an 8 twist, and some people are going 7.5 twist there. And then as you work your way up, you're just going to pick the faster twist for that caliber and for the bullets that you tend to be using. So that's what I'm going to recommend if someone's like, well, I'm going to buy something, or I'm going to build something, and they're asking, you know, for twist rate. And that's kind of the basic counsel I would give.
So moving on to optics, I know exclusively pretty much rifle scopes. What are some of the scopes that you see or like or recommend? I know, you know, first of all, I should probably say you can get a scope for X amount of dollars, or you can get a scope for 4X amount of dollars. So there's a wide range, but what are your kind of your recommendations in 2 or 3 different price ranges?
Well, the scopes that we will see the most of, I would say, would be like Night Force, Leopold, Burris, and Citron, and Vortex. Those would probably be, which shouldn't be a surprise to most people, those are fairly common, and you can spend more or less money in most of those. You know, some of those scopes have different models that are more expensive, but you know, we'll see more expensive scopes, and then we'll see some cheaper scopes that, if, at least cost wise out there as well. So there's, you can skin the cat and not spend a ton of money and still play at distance.
Right. However, you know, don't spend a lot of money on your gun and then skimp on your scope. You know, if you're planning, spread out the wealth between the whole project.
Well, you want a scope that is going to be reliable, especially in its turrets. Mm-hmm. That is something that's, you know, going to be very important, because most guys are dialing, at least primarily for drop. Now they have a first focal plane reticle. They may be holding for wind and using the reticle, and some dial both. But, you know, you're doing a bunch of dialing as you're, you know, working your way out and coming back. And so, you know, if that is true, since we're shooting in the daytime, the glass doesn't have to be the absolute best out there. But if you're wanting it for other purposes, well, then the quality of the glass begins to be more important, depending on the distances you're shooting and things like that.
Right, right. And so, you know, adjustability of turrets, reliability of making sure that the turret clicks the amount of distance that the turret says it clicks is important. And do you recommend first focal plane?
It's easier.
Yeah.
For several reasons, but in our shoot, it's probably, if they're going to hold for wind, it would be almost a requirement, unless mm-hmm. someone's really skilled and knows how to change their magnification and how their reticle subtensions are going to change mm-hmm. if they're going to hold for wind. But that's more of an advanced shooter thing. A scope with a zero stop on it would be really ideal, but there's even some ways to go around that. But a zero stop just keeps everything simple.
Right. Again, just to define the technical terms, a zero stop means that you can just twist your turret until it stops and you'll be back on zero. And then the focal plane thing, we're talking about a first focal plane scope, the reticle changes in size proportion to the magnification, and the second focal plane, the reticle always stays the same size, but the view you see through the scope will change in magnification, just for people who are wondering what those things mean. Okay, so moving on, go ahead.
I was going to say the main way that I would describe first and second focal plane mm-hmm. of why I would emphasize second focal plane if they want to use their reticle for making shot adjustments is, even though on the first focal plane, as you look at it, it grows in size, as you add magnification, the subtensions or the distance between the lines stays the same no matter what magnification. Or on the second focal plane, the distance between the dots or the lines is going to change when you change magnification. And that's not a good thing if you're using your reticle for either drop or drift.
Right, right. Yeah, thank you for that for sure. Okay, so moving to ancillary equipment, specifically bipods and shooting bags, what are your recommendations there? What should people be looking for there? Because typically, let me just say, a lot of it is shot from the prone position where you are laying on the ground on a shooting mat, shooting off a bipod.
Right. And I tell people for a specialty pistol that one of the cheap, easy ways to go is the Harris bench rest version of it that has the swivel feature. And I would encourage them to add a pod lock that has the notched legs. That is kind of the, probably the most bang for the buck bipod there is. But we have, you know, guys that use Atlas and a number of other brands of bipods. And so find the bipod that works for you. And have, if it has a swivel feature so you can, you know, take away your cant, I'd also recommend a scope level would be really ideal as well for getting some of those things set up.
Yeah, that was a recommendation you made to me, that pod lock, which is an accessory you can get for the Harris that just puts the extra oomph on tightening it so it doesn't wobble around. So what about, what about, you know, typically, like I said, the prone position, so you're shooting, laying down, your gun is on a bipod, and you recommend, and I really enjoyed learning how to shoot with a bag under the grip as well. Can you describe, you know, what you recommend in that kind of bag, and then also how to use that bag to kind of enhance how you shoot?
Well, I like to have two bags with me. They're both small. One is Holland's small field bag, and it has like a poly feel to it, and it's like a, it's like brick size. Well, brick shape, it's smaller than a brick, and it can give you more height. And but then I use a small leather little pillow bag, and if I'm not going to be traveling a lot, like up and down a mountain ridge, I'll fill it with heavy sand, and I can make it really tight, easier, and it will stay tight through recoil. So, and the reason for that goes to the second part of your question is we instruct people to use a rear field bag, a small field bag underneath the pistol grip. And with their shooting hand, they're going to be gripping the gun, and their offhand is going to be in the, they're going to have their thumb at the back and their shooting finger or their other finger or both of those in the front of the bag. And then they're going to squeeze that bag. And then with their shooting hand, basically they might even be pushing down, and they're going to make that really tight. And then you want to be able to do that the same amount of tension every time. And so sometimes one little field bag might be a little more advantageous than another, given whether you're shooting up or down or personal preference. But then, you know, as you're pressing on the trigger, your offhand is going to keep continual pressure on that bag. For people who are newer or just getting tired, or they have a gun that really is recoiling too much for them, what people tend to do is when they, as they pull the trigger, their offhand on the bag sometimes will clench. Well, if it's clenching, that means the bag is going to press upward, and it's going to make the grip go up and the muzzle go down and all kinds of wonky, and they're going to make a bad shot. And if they don't tell their spotter, hey, I made a bad shot, I jerked the trigger, then the spotter is going to give unknowingly incorrect correction info. Or if they release the bag as they press the trigger, then the butt's going to go down, the muzzle's going to go up, and their shot's going to go high and a little wonky. So being really consistent on that rear bag is very important. And after a day at Y-Shot, your offhand is probably going to be hurting because you've been gripping that rear bag so hard all day shooting.
True. That's true. I think we should also, since you mentioned it, take a minute to one more thing in the equipment on the gun itself is the importance of a muzzle break. You've written a fantastic article that's in the Six Gunner that anybody can download for free about the importance of a muzzle break, which ones are good, and with some really good detailed photos of how much these guns actually recoil. But that's definitely something that you recommend if someone is buying or building a gun is a good muzzle break, right?
Yes. Well, there are cartridges and weights of gun to where you can get by without doing one. Mm-hmm. So that's very true. Some people we've had a few people use suppressors, mm-hmm. and we allow suppressors. That's not a problem, but a suppressor is not going to give you the recoil reduction that a good solid bottom muzzle brake would. And so I recommend a solid bottom muzzle brake on a lot of your Creed based cartridges, 308 based cartridges, the GT or Dasher class 6.5x47 Lapua. You don't have to get the best muzzle brakes out there to do a good job. You know, there are brakes that work a little bit better, and you just have to decide based on the money that you're going to spend and all of that. But when you get into the bigger cartridges that have more gas, I would especially say in the family of the 284 Winchester family necking down, or in the short action magnums, that's where the better brakes do make a difference. And there's a number of really good brakes out there, and some of that comes down to personal preference, but you can go with just a good base, solid bottom muzzle brake. And for a lot of your short action cartridges, and it will do just fine.
Yeah, and that solid bottom is really important, especially shooting in the prone position to prevent those escaping muzzle gases from blowing dust everywhere. So don't forget the solid bottom part.
Yes, I definitely recommend a solid bottom.
Right. Okay, so away from the gun, I remember when I first went, you know, you kind of had a list of things that people should think to bring that aren't necessarily in the gun. So typically what happens is you will all meet at a staging area, and then you'll drive to the shooting area, and you'll have a bag. And in that bag, of course, since you're outside, you're going to want appropriate clothing, sunscreen, a hat, perhaps knee pads. What are some other things that people should be thinking about to bring that don't have to do with the actual shooting part of it?
You might want bug spray. If we've had a wet year, the mosquitoes mm-hmm. can be bad some years, and other years they're non-existent. So it really just depends on how dry or how wet it is. Shooting glasses are required. You need some kind of eyewear on, mm-hmm. and you need some kind of hearing protection.
Right.
And so those are required. A lot of people want to bring binoculars, and many of them will bring a spotting scope and a tripod. But if you don't have a spotting scope and a tripod, that's okay. There will be someone with a spotting scope and a tripod at each stage, and there will be a shooting mat at each stage. There's some stages where a mat will not be required, especially on day one, but you don't have to bring your own shooting mat. But if you're out doing some prairie dogging before or after the steel shoot, if you're doing the steel shoot, then you might want a shooting mat for those times. But for the steel shoot itself, we have shooting mats. It would be good to have a pen or a pencil and something to write on and something to write down in terms of your drops for a certain stage. So like if there's a stage with 7 targets, that when we get there and you can look at the distance and then you can write your drop for each one of those and given on, let's say we're having a nice day, and we have like we'll pretend it's a, you know, it's a crosswind of about 5 miles an hour, and then you can even put your wind in there and just have it all ready to go, so that when you start running targets out, your drop chart is right there beside you. And you know, sometimes of where do I want to put that drop chart to where I can see it while I'm shooting. There's some different ways to have more of a heads up display with your drops. Some use whiteboards with dry erase markers, and they just start over again, and they have it written out really good, and they kind of make a map of the targets, and then they wipe it down and do it on the next stage. So there's all kinds of ways to do that.
Right, right. And you're right. I remember when I was there, each stage, you know, you have the targets and the list of their ranges, and calculating or writing down, you know, okay, target one, I need to be at this spot on my turret, target two, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very handy to do that. So moving on to kind of how the competition works, it's held outside of Gillette, Wyoming, which is where you live, on a beautiful ranch. If you've ever been to Wyoming, it's really cool country, especially from someone from the hill country of Texas. It's like going to another world, kind of. So we go out, and there's 2 days. Typically, correct me if I'm wrong, the first day is, I'm using air quotes here because nothing is really short range, but the first day is shorter ranges, and the second day is where you really stretch it out. At least that's how it was when I was there.
Yes.
Okay.
So we've always called from the beginning, we called day one the short course and day two the long course.
Right, yeah.
But then we had folks that always wanted to engage a 1,000-yard target at least once, even on the short course, because they wanted to shoot distance. So yeah. Sometimes on day one we might have a 1,000-yard target, but most of the time, it, you know, there might be one target that's over 1,000 yards on day one. But most of the time, it's going to – most of our targets are going to be between – 200 yards and 600 yards. And then we'll have some at 7 and 8 on that day one. And then on day two, again, around 200 yards, a little past 1300 yards.
Yeah. So people have a choice when they come, right? There is a choice. I don't remember. I think the, you can choose to shoot steel or shoot prairie dogs, or you got to do half and half. I don't remember exactly how it works, but both opportunities are available.
That's a good comment, because really you can do it any way you want. Some people come and every year all they do is shoot prairie dogs. This is a this thing was meant to be fun and for people to go for their personal best and to do what they want. And so some people we have some people that only shoot prairie dogs. It's really, it's on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and we close up shop around noon on Wednesday, so it's called a 2.5-day shoot, and some guys shooting dogs that whole time. And we have other people that just shoot steel. They never kill a prairie dog. And then we have more of the rest of the crowd. They do a bit of both. Some will shoot day one and then they'll just spend the rest of their time shooting dogs. Other times guys will shoot both days of the steel course, but then before or after they may be out shooting dogs. And then Wednesday started off as an ELR play day on steel, but then really there weren't that many guys that really had got rigs set up for, you know, long range steel, their ELR distances anyway. And so it wasn't really beneficial. And so we just turned it into a for guys to see how far they could kill a prairie dog on Wednesday. And so that has been fun. We have some challenge coins that you will get that, you know, basically it's a club coin that, you know, the 750-yard club and the 1,000-yard club, the 1,300-yard club and the 1,500-yard club. And hitting the dog doesn't get it there, even if it's witnessed. If it goes in the mound, you're done. Unless you can see it laying in the mound and you want to, and there's confirmed that it's dead and you can see it, and we'll count it. But but if it goes down in the ground, you know, unless you're going to take a backhoe, it's not going to count. So
that's so funny. Yeah, that's true. And for people who haven't seen it, I mean, the first time I was out there, you hear about prairie dogs and it's, yeah, these little squirrel-like ground burrowers, but the amount of damage that these things do. I mean, hard packed country roads that have prairie dogs that have dug through it. And so it is they are a nuisance, and there is no shortage of them. Just for anybody who's curious about prairie dog hunting, it is wild when you go out there. They are everywhere. And I was just shocked by how many. I mean, I'm surprised that, because, you know, where we shot was a working cattle ranch, and I'm surprised that, you know, they don't lose a lot of cattle to broken limbs from stepping in these daggum holes.
Yeah, there's a lot where we shoot. And we have awards for the longest 22 rimfire prairie dog kill. We have a prize for the longest straight wall cartridge kill, and then awards for the longest specialty pistol kill. So we also have that. And we usually give out that on that Wednesday late morning, early afternoon.
That's cool. That's an added. When I was there, you were still doing the ELR, but that's a neat added thing to do. Okay, so the way that it kind of works is that you break everybody into teams or squads, and then you have X amount of shooting stations or positions, and you rotate through those each day. You know, there'll be X amount on the first day of the short course and X amount the second day. There's always a spotter for the shooter. And one thing I want to say about it is, if you haven't been or you're thinking about going, you should absolutely give it a whirl, because one, they may be taken, but Ernie has loaner guns. And two, there are some fantastic long range coaching available as well. Ernie, you helped me a lot. You know, when I came to Wyshot, I was dealing with my target panic and some flinch, and just through doing this and shooting with the scope, by the end of day one, I made a first round hit on an 800 yard target. And by the end of day two, I made a second round hit on a 1400 and something yard target. And it was a huge confidence booster, but it was only because of the coaching of you and other people there, and just the friendliness of the environment. And like what you said, fun. It was fun.
Yeah, we wanted everyone to be safe, but after we get the safety part down, we want people to have fun. I try to put two good spotters in every squad or every group, so that everyone has at least one good spotter. Many times you're going to have two people watching, because sometimes someone won't a shot may be hard to see, and one won't get it and one will. And so we try to give good feedback to our shooters, because especially with the center grip XP or the Nosler pistol or the H&S pistol that are center grip based, you have more muzzle flip just because of the location of where the grip is, where a rear grip tends to not pop as much. It's easier to spot your shots when everything else is equal in terms of the weight of the gun and the cartridge and the bullet and the muzzle velocity. A rear grip is going to be easier for you to spot your own shots with a rear grip, but a center grip is easier to get into funky field positions faster. And that's why a lot of guys like to use the center grips, because what they use for hunting. And so they like the ability, it just seems to be more flexible and balanced better for weird shooting positions.
Very true. That's very true. When someone is considering going, you know, I think, for instance, here in Texas where I am, which I know you're familiar with this area, is we don't have the opportunity very much to shoot at the distances that we do at Wyshot. And I, you know, for me, you know, I use the word competition very loosely, because I don't go to win except against myself. And however, I do like to have some prep. So a couple of things. One, what is your recommendation as far as if you're limited in your range for prep? And two, let's just start there. What are your recommendations about preparation with your gun and shoot and practicing?
Well, one of the best things you can learn to do is, depending on what your max is, let's say that maybe you only have 200 or 300 yards as your max distance. Mm-hmm. If you want to be able to improve your ability to shoot under stress and time, have a buddy go out with you and go to Walmart or some other place that has some 1-inch or 2-inch multiple colored dots, put a big target board up at 200 or 300 yards, and then I would have you start the way you would at Y shot, standing with the bolt open, guns unloaded, and when he says go, and he's going to time you, and then he's going to pick the color, and you don't know it until you get down on the ground, and then you've got to find it and shoot, and he'll pick another color, and you've got to reload and find it and shoot. And it'll do two things. Number one, if you can shoot tight, and number two, you know, it makes you have to look to find a target. And so that those are some skill sets that are important. And the next thing is you're just shooting under time and pressure. And if you guys are taking turns, well, then it's a little competition of who can shoot the closest to that little dot or hit the dot and the fastest at the same time. It's a good way to get your skill set going, and it gets you used to being under pressure a little bit.
Very true. Little difficult if you're colorblind like me. So
then do different target shapes.
Right. Exactly. Squares, circles, triangles.
You can even make up a cheap stencil.
Right.
And just paint them on there. And you can do all kinds of odd stencil shapes. And now you have to find the shape. So even if you're colorblind, there's ways that you can skin that cat.
That's true.
Without using that. So the key is you have to look for the target, find the right one, and you know you're under time, and then you have to make the shot, reload, and many times the center grip will knock you off target a little bit, and by the time you're reloading, you're going to be knocked off. And as you reload, is to be able to, you know, be able to maybe quickly look over the, depending on what you're shooting, look over the top of the gun, make sure it's pointed in the right direction, and then not have your magnification up so high that your field of view is so small that you're sitting around searching. And I usually tell guys at Y shot, I usually run from like an 8 power to like 14 power on most of my shots. And you don't need a lot of magnification, but having a good field of view is very important because it helps you go from target to target and find your targets faster. So, and time is scoring, and scoring is points, and points is money.
Yeah, that's right. And just because I shoot mostly by myself, I use a shot timer with a random start setting on it. And that helps if you don't have a buddy as well. It doesn't necessarily help with the calling out which one is which, but we've done things like number them and then roll dice to see what numbers or whatever, you know, just if you can't, cause like I said, all my shooting buddies live in other places. So I'm limited by that, but that's a little, hack that I use.
Well, yeah. Good creative ways of doing it.
Exactly right. Okay. So going to the rules of the match. So like you said, you start from the standing position and it's under time. And so it's, you know, typical shooting competition style, you know, shooter ready type of deal. And I don't remember, you have to single load, correct?
Well, no, we do allow, if you're shooting a rear grip that has an internal, like the original Remington XP100R that has like a ADL type, you know, internal magazine.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a rear grip, like a Black Widow that has detachable mags.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are fine. Those are legal to have.
Okay.
It took quite a while before a rear grip, overall at Y Shot center grips ruled. And then, the last 2 years, it was a rear grip that won, but it was a single shot. And so a single shot can be competitive even against mag fed rear grips. So it's really going to come down to the shooter and how well he or she is doing on the gun and reading conditions. And that's so, so we've had a lot of center grips of one, we've had rear grips of one, and we've had a rear grip that had a mag when the overall once, I think. Mm-hmm. But everything else has been by single shot.
Mm-hmm. And so are there any other, I mean, obviously the safety rules of firearms apply, but are there any other rules to specifically to Y-Shot that people should be aware of?
Well, so our scoring, I'm not sure when we changed our scoring. I think you were there with the old scoring, but we changed our scoring to put precision, making precision shooting above volume shooting of cleaning a stage. And so for the last several years now, any first round impact on, so let's say we have seven targets and you have to engage each target one time. You have to engage a target and then you can't keep shooting at that target. If you miss it, you have to go, if you shot at target two and you missed it, you have to go to target three. And whether you hit or miss target three, then you go to target four and so on. And then if you have time left over, you can come back and engage any targets that you missed. That remains the same. But now on the scoring part, a first round impact is 2 points. So if you take a little more time and make sure that you've got your wind and your fundamentals all squared away, you'll have a 2 point for impacting that target. Let's say that you have made first round impacts on targets one through three, you missed target four, and let's just pretend that you made first round impacts all the way out to target seven, you have some time left over, you come back and you hit target four. That is a one, you get 1 point for that. And so, but what we were doing is we are rewarding first shot precision. And then we have targets that have flappers that move. We have like animal targets. We have like seven or eight of those. And so if you hit the flapper on a first shot, that's 3 points. And we don't have that many, and it's noted in the in each stage. And so if there's a flapper target and you hit it first round impact, you get 3 points. But let's say you missed, let's say that that flapper target was again target number four, and you come back and have time and you hit target four on your second attempt and you hit the flapper, it's still just 1 point, because it was 3 points if you made it on a first round impact. Anytime after that, it goes to one. And any target over 1,000 yards on a first round impact is 3 points. So we're rewarding first round impacts with higher scores.
There you go. That's
and then when the stage is done, and so then the guy or the gal is going to have to open their bolt. And if they have a magazine, they need to drop it. And then whoever's going up, they're going to do a physical check to make sure the gun is clear. And then the shooter will close the bolt, pull the trigger. And then that bolt needs to stay down. And the mag needs to stay out if it has a mag.
Gotcha.
As we're, you know, until, and then we'll, that way, because if we have a windy day, the dirt and sand will just coat the inside of that action. And that, we don't want that. And that's why we keep bolt closed. And, I mean, if someone wanted to use a flag, you know, like a flag, like what you see at a bench rest match,
right,
that's fine. But if we have a windy day, they're going to be running so much dirt and sand through their action and everything else. It wouldn't be cool. So, and that's why we do it that way.
Yeah. And that's a great segue, because the next thing I wanted to talk about is the wind. When I was there and, it seems like it was very windy, and out on those big open spaces, it's not necessarily where you're at that's windy, and it's not necessarily at the target. It could be different winds in between you and the target. A quick story that I remember from when I was there, there was a competitor, great guy, Jason Ford, who was shooting a six BR, I believe it was, XB, and he was engaging on the second day a descending sized target where it was five separate pieces of steel. I think the range was 450, 460 yards. And it was basically you had to shoot the first target, the second target, all the way through to the fifth target. But if you missed, you had to start back over and you had to clear all those targets.
Know your limits.
Yeah. 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 Know your limits. And so what happened was he shot first, he hit the first target, he hit the second target, he missed the third target. And the wind drifted his bullet to hit the target to the right of it. And then he had to start over. But by his next shot on the third target, the wind had shifted to make his bullet miss the target to the left. And that was just shifting throughout that time. And I watched that happen. And it was like, sometimes it's difficult. And wind calling, like I said, for me here in the hill country, it's not as big a deal. But wind is a big deal there if it's windy, both for, you know, keeping your lips chapped, it'll keep your action dirty, and it will make your shooting more difficult. So what are your tips about shooting in the wind? I know you're good at judging it, and there's some other folks who are as well, but if you're coming at it from someplace you don't have to worry about that, what do you think you need to know?
Well, you brought up Jason. Well, he's a really good shooter.
He is, yes.
And when you start getting out there, you know, a 6BR is on a really beautiful day, a 6BR can just rule the roost because you have a gun that has so little recoil and it can just run and it can beat everyone else. But when you're having switchy winds, those smaller cartridges suffer more. And so you have to decide, you know, what you want to use. I've seen a guy with a 6-dasher. I remember on day one, he won day one with a 6-dasher, and the wind, there was basically no wind. This was either the first or second year of Y shot. And another guy was shooting a 7 SOM and a lot more recoil, shooting 162 AMAXs. And the guy shooting the SOM was like third, I think, or fourth. And day two, the long day, turned out to be really windy. And the 7 SOM not only won day two, but won the overall because the Dasher just suffered because it was a switchy wind. So, and the Dasher has a better performance level than the BR. So, so that's kind of the luck of the draw and the kind of wind we might get or not get on a given day. Who's, you know, and so, but I would just tell you, just bring what you have. And if you're, we've had guys just shoot two fast twist 223 Remingtons and they have fun, they learn. And if it's their gun, then they've just learned their gun really well. And if it's a calm day, a little 223 can do pretty good.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's a good point. You never know what you're going to get. And it was definitely windier on day two. Of course, when I was there, we were kind of up on a hill and, you know, it dipped down to some of the targets that were up on further hills. And that in itself makes the wind different between you and the target. But I really, really, I really enjoyed learning all that. You know, it was like you said, bring what you got because you're going to learn. And that was the most enjoyable part to me.
So here's what I would say on reading wind, to get back to your question, is the best indicator of the wind was your previous shot. And I know that sounds kind of like, well, duh, but at the same time, it's so very true. And, you know, we don't have wind flags. We do put up some streamers on our targets, but sometimes the wind just beats them up and tears them off. And but just because the streamer is going a certain way at the target, as you said, that doesn't mean that's what the wind is doing in between the two. And I would also pay attention to not necessarily the corrections that other shooters make. They're shooting before you, but I would notice if guys are typically shooting low or typically shooting high, that tells you that either because of mirage or conditions or terrain and all of the above, the bullets are going high. And so that ought to kind of make you think. A stage I remember last year on the long course where we had about out to about 1275 or 1300 yards. And for about the first 700 or 800 yards, the wind was really calm and consistent, and your drops would be on. But once you got past, and I don't know if there was a draw or some hills or something, and then it just went, it really changed. And I was paying attention to that. And so I began to tell shooters, you know, listen to what people's calls are typically going. And that's going to give you a good indication that it's possible, it's likely possible that you're going to be running into that same condition or similar conditions when you're up. And so if everyone's shooting low at a certain place, well, you might be determining how low it is, because depending on wind changes, it could be a half minute or even a full minute change up. But and so to pay attention to that, that listening to what other shooters are doing as they're going through a course can be a good education to where those bullets are going on different parts of that stage if it's really strung out.
Yeah, absolutely. Paying attention to everybody else is a good tip for sure. So before we get to just a couple of the details about it that I want to make sure we talk about, is there anything else that people need to consider when coming about what to bring, how to practice, or any of that kind of thing?
Well, what to bring, you know, if you're going to be doing prairie dog shooting, some guys bring portable benches. Mm-hmm. Some people like to bring a certain kind of lawn chair or a certain kind of camping chair that they want to kind of park out in. And we can get our vehicles pretty close to where we're shooting on both stages now. And so you can also be relatively close. Day two, we have to stage our vehicles away, but still it's not that far of a walk. And we try to have water and stuff like that. We have a porta potty there for taking care of those kind of needs. And it's just, it's the kind of thinking is it probably, you know, you need to bring your own food. We don't have a meal out there. So you need to be putting some protein in you, and you need to be drinking enough water and hydrating and sunscreen and like you said, chapstick and that kind of stuff. I don't really recommend tennis shoes. We have a lot of cactus. And so, you know, a hiking boot would be good. We do have rattlesnakes. You just need to be, you always need to be aware of where you're stepping, prairie dog mounds, rocks, and all kinds of stuff like that. But, you know, you need to be aware that you are out in the country. So kind of some common sense rules that I would say in what you bring and in terms of food and water and that kind of stuff.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so just some housekeeping stuff. What is the match fee?
It's $150, whether you're shooting dogs the whole time, steel the whole time, or a bit of both.
And it is well worth it, in my opinion. And when are you having it this year, 2024? What, you typically have it the week after Father's Day, right? You start on Monday after Father's
Day? Yeah, it begins the Monday after Father's Day, and that will be June 17th through the 19th.
Awesome. And this is, like I said, outside of Gillette, Wyoming, which is a decent-sized town. There are several places to stay. Do you have any places to stay that you specifically recommend?
Well, we've had a lot of our guys stay at the Arbuckle, but we have a lot of – we're a town of about 30,000. And so the Hampton Inn, the Holiday Inn Express, the Fairfield, which is a Marriott hotel, and we have a host of others of different prices. And so, you know, we have people who stay in certain places because they have rewards or points, you know, with a certain company. And, you know, all of that is fine. But we have quite a few choices. All you have to do is get on the web, search for hotels in Gillette, and you'll see a plethora of options. We are, the ranch we're on is northwest of Gillette, but that doesn't really change much where you stay in Gillette. It's not really going to make any difference.
Right.
It's not that big of a town.
Well, I just want to say again, when I came, I was really in the throes of my target panic, and Wyshot, I can specifically remember the last stage of the first day being the moment when things started clicking for me. I was very focused on reticle focus and trigger press, and it just started clicking, and I was able to, like I said, make first round hits at almost 800, and then the next day continued to improve, and it was a huge watershed moment in my shooting, and I finished 11th, and I would rather have had that experience than one, because it was just such a cool, I mean, for me personally, it was a very upbuilding and motivating time. Everybody was super fantastic and a lot of help, a lot of fun for sure. So thank you for that. Last thing.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah. And it really was. I mean, like you take care of folks and there are a lot of really good experienced shooters out there and everybody is super friendly. So if people want to know more or have any more questions, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, you can, there are several ways. You can email me, and the best way, one way to email me is I have a website. I have a side gig. I'm the U.S. dealer for Seb Rest, which is a high-end joystick rest, and we even make a joy. I don't make it. I'm just the dealer, and a joystick bipod, and then we have also a rear bag. This is for short range bench rest, long range bench rest, F class, air rifle and rimfire. And so I have a website for that. SEBRESTS-USA.com. Or you could just Google search Seb Rest USA. SEB Rest USA. And you're gonna see a website that has a charcoal background. It's going to say Seb USA in light blue. And then when you go to menu, you'll see there's a Wyshot tab on that. And then there's also a contact us. And so the contact us goes directly to my email, and my email address is my first name and my wife's first name connected together. It's ErnieEmily@yahoo.com. That's ErnieEmily@yahoo.com. A phone number you can call, this is a landline, 307-257-7431. 307-257-7431. That is a landline, and there's voicemail if I don't answer it. And then if it's about Wyshot and stuff like that, then I will probably end up giving you my cell number, and I'll be glad to answer any questions. I do have loaner guns. I have a number of them. You do have to pay for the ammo that you shoot, but the use of the loaner pistol is no cost. It's just kind of my way of encouraging new shooters to be able to use a gun that is already set up for shooting distance, and they can begin to have an idea of like, oh, wow, this is not as hard as I thought, or now I know kind of what I'm looking for my kind of shooting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I have some rear grip and some center grip loaner pistols that I have available every year. I also have the ammunition for them already on hand. So, but you would need to get with me on that.
Right. And we will make sure that all of those ways to contact you are in the show notes for this podcast as well. Ernie, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Folks, if you haven't been to Wyshot, I highly recommend it. You'll learn a lot. It's a lot of fun, and it's in some beautiful country as well. Ernie, again, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, sir. And look forward to the next time you can be at my way.
Again, I want to recommend to anybody thinking about it that you go give Wyshot a try. Wyshot is the middle competition of a week and a half of three different competitions. Handgun Hunters Competition, Wyshot, and the MOA Shoot are all within a couple days of each other. So if you have a week and a half to go in the middle of June to Wyoming, I highly recommend going to all three. If you're interested in learning about drop and drift, how to use your scope reticle, seeing what you can do with your specialty pistol, I cannot recommend enough going to Wyshot. Again, like Handgun Hunters Competition, there are so many friendly people there that are just willing to help you out, coach you, or just give advice based on their experience. Wyoming is a completely different spot from a lot of places in the country, and so you have a lot of chance to fit a lot of experience in a little time in a cool environment. So I recommend you go. Plus, you'll be, if you've never been there, you'll be amazed by the amount of prairie dogs that you'll have the chance to go shoot as well. So Wyshot, check it out. And thank you all so much for listening to the Short Gun Sportsman. If you like it, I hope that you give us a like and subscribe, comment on it, and we'll see you on the next one. This podcast is produced by Handgun Hunters International. HHI is the only organization dedicated solely to supporting and growing the sport of handgun hunting. Membership gets you access to our great, well-moderated forum where friendly handgun hunters of all experience levels share stories and information from folks that have actual experience in our sport. We also host giveaways to our members of guns, gear, and ammo every month, and each prize is worth several times what membership costs. In addition to this podcast, we publish a free digital magazine, The Six Gunner, which is written exclusively by HHI members. If you are a handgun hunter or support handgun hunting in any way, you need to be a member of HHI. Join today at handgunhuntersinternational.com. Again, if you have any questions on how to get started in handgun hunting, please reach out to me at ryan@handgunhuntersinternational.com. If you think we deserve it, please leave us a 5-star review and don't forget to follow Handgun Hunters International on social media @HandgunHuntersINT. God bless and good hunting.